And good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of the program, we will be talking about Iran, and we will be spending a lot of time talking about the role in contemporary Iranian history played by the man who was the leader of the Iranian Revolution, the Ayatollah Khomeini. And our guest for the program is someone who has been following politics in the Middle East for a long time. He's one of Britain's leading journalists. His name is Con Coughlin. He's the executive foreign editor of the Daily Telegraph, and he is the author of a recently published book about Iran. The title of his book is Khomeini's Ghost, The Iranian Revolution and the Rise of Militant Islam. It is published by CCCO Books. That's an imprint of HarperCollins. And the book is out now, and certainly if you're interested in taking a look at it, you can hunt it down. Also, of course, questions are welcome this morning, as always. We give people the opportunity to make comments, ask questions. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people who are calling in try and keep their questions and comments as brief as possible so that we are able to get in as many different callers as possible. But certainly anyone who is listening is welcome to give us a call and join in on the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, certainly, if you'd like to join in the conversation, you can do that. Mr. Coughlin, hello.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a great pleasure to be with you today.
And I think I should mention that he is in England, so I think we have pretty good connection given the distance. So I appreciate you talking with us. And just as a kind of point, a general point to start out with, the point that you make in the book, and certainly this is not just your judgment, but it is the judgment of a lot of people, that the Iranian Revolution is one of the most significant events of the last century. Yes?
I would argue that, and I think if you look at many of the problems we face today, particularly if you look at the list of foreign policy priorities that the new American president, President Barack Obama, will have to grapple with, Israel, Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, if you look closely enough, you'll see that it all traces back to Iran and the activities of the Revolutionary Guards. And the reason for that, which is the main thesis of the book, is that the principles of the revolution that Ayatollah Khomeini presided over in 30 years ago in 1979 are still very much in evidence in modern Iran today. The regime that runs Iran under the spiritual leader Ali Khamenei is totally committed to maintaining and fulfilling the fundamental principles of the revolution that Ayatollah Khomeini established, which includes exporting the revolution and also becoming a nuclear power.
Mm-hmm. And here, I think the important point is indeed, and we can talk some more about this man, but that indeed 30 years after the revolution and now a number of years after his death, he passed away in 1989, that his ideas continued to be very important and influential in setting the policy, the foreign policy of Iran.
Oh, very much so. And I mean, I think if you want to understand modern Iran and basically understand how do we deal with modern Iran, you really have to grasp this fundamental fact that what we're dealing with is not the Iranian revolution, but Khomeini's revolution. And from virtually from day one, from the day that he arrived back from Paris in early February 1979, he shaped the Iranian revolution in his image. He'd spent many years in exile thinking about it, writing about it, the kind of Islamic state that he wanted to create. And having created a very uncompromising, some would say, Islamic state in Iran, he basically committed his successors to create this kind of state throughout the Islamic world. And so, I mean, people say, well, you know, this is very difficult because Iran is basically a Shia country and the majority of Muslims, particularly in the Middle East, are Sunni and they don't get on. There's this great historical fissure between the different traditions. But then you look at the support the Revolutionary Guards have given to Hamas, which is a Sunni organization. Today, Iran is the biggest funder of Hamas in Gaza. The Revolutionary Guards have even linked up with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Now, in 1999, Iran nearly went to war with the Taliban because the Taliban had killed some Iranian diplomats. But today, and talk to British commanders in southern Afghanistan, which I've done, and they will tell you that the Revolutionary Guards going through the border crossing of Herat are supplying the Taliban with the roadside bombs that are being used against British and other coalition forces. The Americans are too far away to be in direct contact with the Iranians in Afghanistan for the moment, but they're playing around. And so what I would describe as the tentacles of terror all go back to Terror HQ in Tehran.
Hmm. One of the central questions here, I think, is that what was it about him that made it possible for him to be, during his lifetime, so popular in Iran, and even after he had passed away, for him to be a revered figure and for his ideas and his priorities to continue to set the agenda for contemporary Iran?
Well, David, I mean, there are several factors in this, but I think the two fundamental points that I would make is, first of all, the Iranian people was very glad to see the back of the Shah and his regime, and that just getting rid of the Shah engendered all kinds of very deep emotions within Iran. And Khomeini, even though it's my contention that many Iranians misunderstood what Khomeini was all about, and particularly the kind of radical Islamic regime he wanted to establish, the Iranians were very drawn to Khomeini, A, because he lived in exile for so long. He'd been in exile for about 16 years before he came back to lead the revolution. And so he'd become a rather enigmatic figure who'd moved from Turkey to Iraq to Paris, who sent out lots of messages and cassettes and pamphlets, basically calling for the Shah's overthrow. And Khomeini was a very, very clever man. And part of the art of Khomeini was to position himself, really from the 1960s onwards, as the most uncompromising opponent of the Shah, the man who would not allow any compromise whatsoever with the Shah. This was a man who was determined to get rid of the Shah or perish in the attempt. And that had a very deep and widespread appeal for many Iranians.
Mm-hmm. There were other opponents to the Shah. There were secular opponents to the Shah. And one of the things that I was certainly wondering about was, why is it that to the extent that there was a secular opposition, that it was not more successful?
I think it's a question of organization. First of all, I mean, really from the early 1960s on, the Shah and his secret service, SAVAK, his intelligence service, brutally repressed any and all political opposition in Iran. And so the traditional opposition parties, like the National Front, were basically eviscerated by SAVAK and the security forces. So those who stayed in Iran had a very tough time indeed. But of course, Khomeini was drawing on the religious community for his support, the clerics and the religious people of Iran. And so it was more difficult for SAVAK and the security forces to persecute religious people. They did, of course, on occasion. And many of Khomeini's supporters, like Rafsanjani, etc., did jail time. But generally speaking, it was more difficult for the Shah to persecute the religious community in Iran than it was to destroy the political establishment. And so for this reason, as the Shah became quite weak, really, in the late 1970s, Khomeini was able to draw on this widespread religious support and turn it into a popular movement, and it became highly effective. And the politicians, people like Bazargan and the other sort of prominent political figures in Iran of the period, realized that they could not compete with Khomeini's superior organization, and so they threw their support behind Khomeini, which of course just increased his popularity throughout the country.
To what extent was Khomeini's opposition to the Shah and that of people who were in his circle and who were clerics who came out of the religious world, to what extent was that shaped by their opposition to the Shah as an individual, his values, his priorities, particularly those all of those things that were associated with what was called the White Revolution? And to what extent was it that the Shah actually, and perhaps this was part of the White Revolution, was really challenging the power of the clerics, and so that it was perhaps not just a battle over principles, but it was also a battle over who had power and influence in Iran?
Well, this lies at the heart of the development of Iran in the 20th century. I mean, the century opens with a monarchical dictatorship, which had basically sold the country to various foreign powers, the British and the Russians in particular. And there was a growing middle class in Iran, the Bazaaris, that wanted very much to have an accountable government. And just before the First World War, there was a revolution, the constitutional revolution, in Iran, where the emerging bourgeoisie was trying to establish a form of government that was more democratic and accountable. And at that early stage in the development of Iran, the clerics said, well, actually, we are a Muslim nation, and even though we support the change in the way that the country is run, we demand that certain Islamic principles are enshrined in the new constitution. And this tension, which started very early on in the century, lasted right up until the revolution of 1979. And if you study the period immediately after Khomeini came back, there was a lot of tension. Iran very quickly descended into open civil war in 1979 and 1980. Between those who supported Khomeini and wanted a rigorous Islamic state and those who wanted a sort of more democratic republic, a more secular system of government.
The United States had been involved in the politics of Iran for some time before the revolution, and I suppose the most notable example would be the involvement of the United States in the 1953 coup. There. And this, which was something that certainly the Iranian people remembered, if the people of the United States didn't. So that sort of, that certainly would have given people in Iran reason to have negative feelings about the United States. But is it correct, do you think, that the anger directed towards the United States, was that mostly about the perception that the United States was indeed the chief backer of the Shah?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a very vexed area. If you look at the history of Iran in the 20th century, what comes across loud and clear is that the Iranians are a very fierce and nationalistic people. And the century started with Russia and Great Britain competing for influence. And as those world powers diminished, as the century progressed, the United States, as the new kid on the block, started to take a very close interest in Iran. And particularly after the creation of the Soviet Union, Iran became a very important focus for the United States and the CIA. And the Shah very cleverly positioned himself as an ally of the West, and he wanted to modernize Iran, he wanted to westernize Iran, and to an extent he wanted to model Iran on neighboring Turkey, where Kemal Atatürk had established a pro-Western secular government in an Islamic state. And the Shah was very keen to do that. The Americans were very, very happy to support him. And so when the fierce nationalism of the Iranians took shape in the form of the whole oil nationalization campaign of Mossadegh in the 1950s, the Americans wanted, for purely commercial reasons, strategic reasons, and political reasons, to support the Shah, because they feared that if the nationalists overthrew the Shah, which is what they sought to do, then America would lose a very important ally in the region and a bulwark against the Soviet Union. Mm.
I should take a moment here to introduce again our guest, Con Coughlin. He is the executive foreign editor of the Daily Telegraph, a British newspaper. He's the author of a best-selling book, Saddam, His Rise and Fall, about Saddam Hussein and Iraq. He appeals regularly on television and radio in the U.S., has been a frequent political commentator on CNN and NBC and MSNBC. He's also written for The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic Monthly. He makes his home in London. He's speaking to us from there. He is the author of a recently published book about Iran and about the Ayatollah Khomeini, and the title of his book is Khomeini's Ghost, The Iranian Revolution and the Rise of Militant Islam. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about Ruhollah Khomeini and something about his origins. And I think that one of the things that's certainly true is if you look at him and his youth, he was not born to a wealthy and influential family, certainly. And I think you'd have to say that given where he ended up, just how important he was in the history of his country, given his origins, it seems a little surprising. That was quite the journey that he made from his hometown to becoming the leader of the country.
Yes, and as I would contend, one of the most influential figures of the 20th century. It's mm-hmm. quite an achievement. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, he was born in very, very, modest circumstances. I wouldn't say poor, but modest circumstances in a remote part of Iran. His father died when he was less than a year, probably killed by bandits as he drove to the regional capital to complain about the local landlords ripping him off. And so Khomeini was orphaned, brought up by his sisters and his aunts, and went to the local school, which was something of a luxury. But he proved himself to be quite a clever young boy, and by the age of 16 was able to move into one of the seminaries, and he proved himself to be a very able student. But if you look at his early life, when he finally sort of settled in one of the bigger seminaries in Qum, he basically immersed himself in religious study, and in normal circumstances would just have become a very devout but obscure religious figure.
So then the question is, how and why did he become involved in politics?
Well, I think, he was a young man during the turbulent period of the Constitutional Revolution, and he felt very strongly, as did a lot of people in Qum at the time, that it was very important that Iran's destiny be shaped by its Islamic nature. And he studied jurisprudence, Islamic law, for a very long period, and came to the conclusion that it is if the country was to reflect the will of God, it needed to be governed by clerics and not by wastrel politicians.
He always felt that Iran should be an Islamic state governed by Sharia, Islamic law. One thing, though, apparently in his thinking that did change was that he initially was committed to the idea of secular leadership, and then at some point changed his thinking, and then his idea was that the supreme leader of the country should be a cleric. How did that change? Do you have some idea, some thoughts about how it is that change came about?
Well, I think it was more to do with experience than anything else. I think he realized that if it, because of the various failures of the secular political establishment to seize control of the country from the Shah, he came to the conclusion that the only people that could actually do this effectively and maintain the country's Islamic identity were the clerics. And so he moved gradually towards this position where all power in the country should be invested in the leading religious figure. But even so, I mean, and if you look at Iran today, I mean, Iran is a democracy. It has a parliament. It has a democratically elected president and politicians. And so he wanted a framework where the overall figurehead of the country, the figure that we would know as the spiritual leader, had overall control for steering the country in the right Islamic direction. But the day-to-day business of the country could be left to the secular politicians, which is really the arrangement they have today.
Mm. He became certainly a well-known and outspoken opponent of the Shah, at one point arrested and actually was jailed for a while, then was exiled, spent most of the time out of the country living in Iraq. He was living in France at the time that he came back then, at the time of the revolution after the Shah left. And apparently some people in the Shah's government thought simply that he should be killed. And I think also that I read somewhere that when he was in France, that the French, somewhere in the French government, they actually made the offer to the Shah's government to do that, to get rid of Khomeini for him. And the Shah, and apparently enough people around him, thought that that was not a good idea.
Yes, well, various offers were made to kill Khomeini. I mean, the Shah himself was minded to execute Khomeini in 1964 before he sent him into exile. The Iraqis, when Khomeini was living in exile in southern Iraq in the 1970s, the Iraqis, who had fallen under the spell of Saddam Hussein, offered to get rid of Khomeini. I'm not sure about the French. Certainly the French were quite keen to keep him in France at one period, because they felt that all their interests in Iran would be compromised if Khomeini was to go back. But the Shah at each stage, I mean, the Shah was a rather weak and feckless man, and he took the view that to kill Khomeini and make him a martyr would only make matters worse. And so he always said, no, that sanction is too much. We must allow him to live.
We're at our midpoint again here. Our guest is Con Coughlin. He is the author of the book Khomeini's Ghost, The Iranian Revolution and the Rise of Militant Islam. He is the executive foreign editor of the Daily Telegraph paper and has written quite a lot on the politics of the Middle East. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. When Khomeini came back to Iran after the Shah was gone, certainly he got a very enthusiastic welcome. Did he, do you think at that point he had a plan? That is, he knew what he wanted to do. It was fairly certain of how he would go about it and what kind of country would result?
Well, when he had been in exile, he'd written various pamphlets about the nature of Islamic government. I mean, he'd written various works of what we would know as political philosophy, in which he'd set out his thoughts on how an Islamic republic might work, with the supreme religious leader of the country overseeing the government of the country, and he was very keen that the clerical establishment was not kept under the yoke of the politicians, which had happened in the past. So there was lots of documentation that Khomeini had put together, but very few people had read it. that was a problem. It was basically kept to his students in Najaf and other places. And very few Iranians really understood what Khomeini was about. And Khomeini himself, of course, when he returned to Tehran after many years in exile, was unfamiliar with the political landscape of Iran, particularly after the overthrow of the Shah. And lots of secular politicians had thrown their hat into the Khomeini ring. But, of course, they expected something in return. And Khomeini had played this rather clever game while in exile in Paris, basically positioning himself as the leader of the liberation movement without actually spelling out very clearly what this liberation movement sought to achieve. And so when he got to Tehran in February 1979, one of the first things he had to do was to try and rein in the aspirations of the other political parties, the National Front and such like, and gradually sort of dissuade them from setting up a secular republic.
So you've now talked about the fact that people really didn't, they perhaps had one idea or one set of expectations of what would happen, and that he apparently had another, and they really didn't understand what kind of country he had in mind. And this was simply because it wasn't that he didn't have a plan, but that he did have an idea. It's just that he didn't talk about it. He didn't say, this is the kind of country that I think Iran should be.
Yeah, well the first chapter of the book is called Stealing the Revolution, and I've spoken to many people who were with Khomeini in those early days of the revolution from different perspectives. You know, Ayatollahs who supported him, secular politicians who supported him, and they feel that he just cheated the Iranian people out of the kind of post-Shah political settlement that many of them had been expecting. And if you look around the world today, the biggest class of Iranian exiles are the middle classes. They were the people who were driven out after the overthrow of the Shah, because they had initially thought that they would be newly enfranchised in the post-Shah revolution.
Mr. Coughlin? I think we've just lost the guest. I'm sure, though, we can get that straightened out. We'll put the call through again, and we'll continue our conversation with Con Coughlin. And again, I guess they'll just give me an opportunity to introduce once again. We're talking this morning with Con Coughlin. He is one of Britain's leading journalists. He serves as the executive foreign editor of the Daily Telegraph, has written a lot on the politics of the Middle East. He is the author of the book Saddam, His Rise and Fall. That's about Saddam Hussein and Iraq. He appears regularly on television and radio in the United States, has been a frequent political commentator on CNN, NBC, MSNBC. He's also written for the Wall Street Journal and the Atlantic Monthly. He makes his home in London. He's speaking with us from there. And he is the author of a recently published book about Iran, particularly looking at the role of the Ayatollah Khomeini in the Iranian Revolution. The title of his book is Khomeini's Ghost, The Iranian Revolution and the Rise of Militant Islam. And indeed, it makes the point, as we have here in the conversation, and certainly as a lot of other people have, that the revolution that he led, the Iranian Revolution, was one of the most significant events in the last century. Again, questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, we have you back. We lost you for a moment there.
That's right, I'm back.
Good. As you mentioned, the Ayatollah came back to Iran in the winter of 1979. This was February 1979. Then it was that fall, it was October, that we have the hostage crisis. What were his feelings about that?
Well, he had a very sort of mixed attitude towards that. I mean, as I said earlier, Khomeini wanted himself to be the figurehead of the revolution. He didn't want to get his hands dirty with the day-to-day administration of the government. And in the summer of 1979, he withdrew with his close followers to Qom, the holy city in Iran, where he'd spent many of his early years studying. And he really wanted to try and distance himself from the day-to-day government of the country. So, excuse me, when
some rather over-enthusiastic students occupied the American embassy, Khomeini didn't know much about it. And the government sent various senior officials to Qom to find out what he thought. And it took him about 48 hours to work out that actually the embassy siege was proven very popular. And at that time, as I said, he was trying very hard to win over the battle for hearts and minds of ordinary Iranians. And he saw this as a great publicity stunt. I mean, I would say that the American embassy had been occupied a couple of times previously, but Khomeini had basically told the students to get out of the compound, and they'd left. And the same morning that the American embassy was occupied in October, the British embassy was also occupied by students, but they left after a few hours. And there was this general feeling that it wouldn't last that long. But, of course, once Khomeini gave his backing to what the students were up to, and, of course, the reason the embassy was occupied in the first place is the Shah had been admitted to the United States for treatment on his cancers. Once the spiritual leader, the guardian of the revolution, gave his backing to what the students were up to, then the die was cast.
Certainly the character of Iran, its priorities have been shaped by this troubled relationship with the United States. And that has done a lot to, I'm sure, to make post-revolutionary Iran or Iran as it is today, the place that it is. One other thing I'd like to have you talk about, though, is the Iran-Iraq war, because it certainly seems to me that also in many ways that conflict has defined and shaped Iran as it is today.
It is, because it first of all, let's not forget that Iran was attacked. Saddam Hussein saw an opportunity. The reason the Iraqis attacked was that they were very concerned of the influence that Iran, particularly after the revolution, was having on the Shia Muslims of southern Iraq. And, of course, this concern is something we've experienced many years later, after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. The Iraqis invaded Iran because they saw an opportunity. The Iranians defended themselves, and within a year or two had completely turned the tables. But the problem was that the war settled into this brutal war of attrition that lasted for 8 years and cost literally hundreds of thousands of lives. And Saddam Hussein started using weapons of mass destruction. I mean, that's well documented, the chemical weapons attacks on Iranian troops and things like that. And it really got the regime, and Khomeini was still alive, of course, but it got the regime in this mindset that it needed to have its own weapons of mass destruction to defend itself. And that therein lies the origins of the nuclear program.
Yeah, that's certainly the next point that I was coming to. Now, one of the chief, maybe the chief worry as far as the government of the United States is concerned, chief worry about Iran, is the contention of the United States that Iran is interested in developing nuclear weapons. And, of course, all along here, very consistently, the government of Iran has said, no, we're not interested in that. What we're interested in is developing nuclear power as a source of electricity. So the concern of the United States is that Iran is developing nuclear weapons, that it's a concern that is shared by other countries as well. And one of the things that you argue in the book is, in fact, that it was the Ayatollah Khomeini who was the one first who said that Iran should start a program to develop nuclear weapons. And it goes back, and indeed goes back to this point, and has a lot to do with the way that he felt about the war with Iraq.
Yeah. Well, again, just as Khomeini vacillated over the siege of the American embassy, he also had conflicting views over the whole nuclear issue in Iran, because when he came to power, the Shah had a quite well-advanced and very ambitious plan to build 25 nuclear power stations throughout Iran. And that there were some other research reactors that might have had other uses. So when Khomeini came to power, he thought that this all represented the decadent West and cancelled the programs. But as the course of the war took a turn for the worse, and yeah, literally, as I said, hundreds of thousands of the Iranians were losing their lives, Khomeini was belatedly persuaded that to fight modern wars, you needed modern weapons. And so he instructed the Supreme Defense Council to do everything it could to initiate this program. And that is why it's so difficult for the regime today to back away from this. Now, you know, American and European intelligence experts do not know precisely where the Iranians are now on a military nuclear program. All we know is they certainly had one until 2003, and they concealed it from the rest of the world. Now, whether they've resumed that program is hard to tell. A lot of the experts I talked to say that the indications are that there is still aspects of a clandestine program, but you know, after the problems we had with Saddam's WMD, nobody's to put their hand up and say Iran is definitely working on a nuclear program with a military complexion at this moment.
Mm-hmm. It seems very clear that Iran is not going to respond to threats. Then the question is, can one imagine a more diplomatic method if what the United States and Great Britain and other countries, if they would prefer not to see Iran with nuclear weapons, is there some way that Iran could be persuaded that that they'd be better off simply not doing that?
Well, I've followed the Iran issue very closely for the last 20 years, and particularly the last 6 years. You know, the Europeans, I mean, forget, I know that the people will argue that the Bush administration's intervention on the Iran issue was deeply unhelpful. But, you know, let's just remember that most of the hard work on trying to resolve this issue has been undertaken by the Europeans. The so-called EU3, Britain, France and Germany, have spent the last 6 years trying to negotiate a reasonable deal with Tehran, whereby Iran basically suspends the uranium enrichment program, which it doesn't particularly need for the nuclear power stations, because all the fuel is being provided by Russia. So there has been this painstaking diplomatic process, but at every turn, the Iranian regime has ignored basically the very lucrative deal on offer by the Europeans and carried on with its illicit nuclear program. So the omens aren't good. All I would say is that I think having the new president in the White House has changed many, many things and many, many attitudes, and it's going to be very, very hard for Iran to ignore this forthright appeal from President Barack Obama to unclench its fist and enter into a proper and realistic dialogue with the West.
Hmm. Just yesterday, I think this was just yesterday, the New York Times reported that President Obama had sent a letter to Mr. Medvedev, the president of Russia, suggesting that if Russia would do what it could to prevent Iran from developing weapons, the weapons we're kind of talking about, then the United States would entertain the notion of backing off from anti-missile system that the Bush administration had talked about putting into Europe. Now, apparently the Obama administration, now after the story broke, the administration said, well, that wasn't quite like that. You might comment on that, but particularly I'm interested in what sort of influence Russia might have over the government of Iran. And is it reasonable to think that the Russians might have a significant role to play?
Well, the Russians have a lot of influence over Iran, because the Russians are building the nuclear power station, and they are committed to provide the the nuclear fuel rods that will power up that nuclear power station. They have an enormous amount of influence. But the problem with the Russians, in my view, is that they have taken great delight in undermining the European effort I just mentioned, which was backed by Washington. And you know, they've offered to give the Iranians very sophisticated anti-aircraft missile systems that would protect the key nuclear installations like Natanz. But of course, Russia, like the rest of the world, is now in very, very deep trouble economically. And the days when the Russians could cock a snoot at Washington and the rest of the world over Iran may be a thing of the past. I also get the sense that President Obama is not as committed to the national missile defense system that's supposed to be located in Eastern Europe as his predecessor. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly room for negotiation there. But even if the Russians did withhold their contractual obligations to Iran on the nuclear power program, the rhetoric coming out of Iran, particularly when they had held their media open day at the Bushehr plant last week, is that the world has to get ready to live with a nuclear Iran. That is where the regime is taking Iran on this issue, and I think it's very difficult to see how you can stop it.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have some calls here that I'll get to. I do, again, want to introduce our guest, Con Coughlin. He is executive foreign editor of the Daily Telegraph. He is author of the recently published book, Khomeini's Ghost, which is published by Echo. I was misreading the name
Echo,
of the,
yeah.
the publisher.
It's HarperCollins.
Echo, which is HarperCollins. It almost looks, if you don't look real closely, that it might be CCCO, and it's actually ECCO. So, maybe I'd get my eyes checked. Echo is the publisher. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Decatur is our first caller, line one. Hello.
Yes, I seem to remember back during the Bush administration, Ahmadinejad may have sent a letter to Bush indicating that he would back off the nuclear program if we would assure Iran that we wouldn't strike them militarily. Is that correct, or did I just dream that?
There have been various offers by Iran. I wouldn't say it's a concrete offer. I think the Iranians have been putting out feelers to the Bush administration. I mean, the reason Iran stopped its military program, and you know, there's no doubt Iran had a military nuclear program until 2003. The reason it stopped its nuclear military program was it was terrified that after what happened in Iraq, the Bush administration would turn its guns on Iran. Now, of course, the history of Iraq became very problematic, which is probably an understatement, and so the Bush administration didn't really have much time for Iran. Ahmadinejad, when he came to power 4 years ago, one of his first acts, if you remember, was to unfreeze the Natanz facility and basically sacked the previous negotiating team that had worked trying to negotiate a resolution of this problem, put in a new, more hard-line, uncompromising team and said, you know, let's get on with what we're supposed to be doing. And that's really been the story of Iran's nuclear program for the last 4 years.
All right. Next is Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. My question is, why would the Iranians be willing to give up a nuclear weapon at this point, as long as Israel has them? Iran has not attacked a neighbor in 200 years, with the possible exception of the Shah seizing some Iranian lands that Iraq had seized earlier. But Israel has attacked its neighbors half a dozen times in the last 50 years. I can't see how the Iranians would be, if they're at all sane, be willing to give up a nuclear weapon until there is disarmament throughout the Middle East. And it seems to me that Pakistan in particular is a much greater danger than Iran would be.
Well, Mr. Coughlin, your comment?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't particularly want to get in the business of defending Israel's nuclear arsenal.
I'm glad to hear that.
Because that's not really my thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all I would say is that, and you know, if you talk to Israelis and Israeli officials, they insist that, you know, they developed their nuclear weapons to defend themselves from, you know, a very hostile neighborhood.
With the fourth largest.
To attack anybody. Mm-hmm. I think a lot, if you look at Iran and the way that Iran has sought to export its revolution and its support for terrorism, I mean, for many years now, Iran has been on, you know, the State Department's list of countries that sponsor terrorism. This far predates the Bush administration and 9/11. Iran has been a major sponsor of international terrorism for many, many years. And I think most intelligence security analysts fear that Iran, with a nuclear weapons capability, could easily be tempted to let these kinds of devices fall into the hands of people like Hezbollah or whoever. And the implications of that would be quite horrendous.
I hope the caller will forgive me. We just have about 2 minutes. I have one other caller I'd like to try to get. This is also someone in Urbana in line 3. Hello.
Hi, yeah. Much of the discussion in the West on negotiations with Iran over the nuclear file assumes that the only acceptable, reasonable outcome has to be ceasing of enrichment of uranium by Iran. And that seems like something that ought to be interrogated. I'm sure you're aware that former Ambassador Pickering has proposed that there be an agreement on multinational enrichment of uranium in Iran with full IAEA inspection, full international participation. And it's not immediate clear why this should be simply ruled out of consideration, that the end game has to be a no enrichment of uranium at all in Iran, which seems to be a non-starter, not only in terms of the Iranian government, but Iranian public opinion. I wonder what your reaction is to that.
Well, the problem with all this is everything that Iran has done on the nuclear enrichment front, it's done illegally. Natanz was built without any details of it being passed to the IAEA. In fact, we wouldn't know that Natanz existed had its existence not been revealed by an Iranian dissident group. So the problem with this is that the Iranians, under successive presidents, people like Mohammad Khatami, who we regarded in the West as a moderate president, Natanz was built under this president. And because the Iranians have deceived the West and the international community and the IAEA, there has been a serious breakdown in trust. And I think the various deals that have been put together by the EU3 have suggested that, yes, there could be a possibility of international cooperation on these areas, but the idea of Iran just pressing ahead on its own is totally unacceptable to the international community.
We are at the point here where we've got to stop. I can give you about a minute to ask the question I'm sure I always ask when we have these kinds of conversations, and that is, what do you see as the possibility of more normal relations between Iran and the United States?
Well, I think a lot rests on the presidential election in Iran this June. And I think if Ahmadinejad is reelected, I think given his attitude over the last 4 years, I think we can look forward to further confrontation with Iran between Iran, the United States, and the West.
And is there significant opposition, or does he have enough support from the, particularly from the ruling clerics, so that you would think that the chances are that he would be reelected?
Well, the problem is that the last three elections in Iran, the parliamentary elections and presidential elections, have been completely controlled by the Revolutionary Guards, who are there to protect the Khomeini's legacy. And it's very difficult for people who do not subscribe to Khomeini's legacy and the hardline interpretation of the Islamic Revolution to become candidates. So that is the problem. But it's something that people are aware of, and perhaps this time there will be candidates who have a more conciliatory attitude towards the West.
Yeah. There we must leave it. Our guest, Con Coughlin, is the executive foreign editor of the Daily Telegraph and is the author of the book Khomeini's Ghost, The Iranian Revolution and the Rise of Militant Islam. Echo Books is the publisher. Mr. Coughlin, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.